Cape.
Just a short resume about this morning. I was discussing the various meanings of the word Maya, which in Sanskrit means illusion. Or at least that's the way it's generally translated. Now, I was trying to explain that it doesn't necessarily mean illusion in a bad sense. When we say a person is suffering from delusions, hallucinations, and so on, it's always a put-down word. But Maya is not so necessary. So I showed you how it has the meanings of measurement, as when we pretend that the world is divisible, actually, into feet or inches or seconds or degrees, and divide things from each other by these measurements, that is to say, by the cutting power of thought. Thought, from in the Latin, scio, means to cut. And so thought is, you see, what you have to understand is that everything is really a think. A thing is a unit of thought in the same way as an inch is a unit of measurement. We divide the wiggly, continuous, wobbly, wild Rorschach blot of the physical universe into things so that we can think about it. And one thinks by a process which is essentially the calculus. Calculate. Calculus, what was it originally? So the word calculus means a pebble, originally. So I count, I remember something, 1, 2, 3, 4 times, 4 pebbles. Like using your fingers. Rosaries have been used for this purpose. And so later the abacus is a kind of amazing rosary. That's calculation, you see. Pretending that the world is a collection of bits. But the world isn't a collection of bits. The world is continuous in the sense that every bit of it is interrelated as much as a human body. You realize, you know, if you magnify the human body to an enormous degree so that you are looking at its individual molecules, one molecule of our body is the size of my fist, say, you know, magnified to that size, the next one would be the other side of the room. Now, what joins them together? I move my hand, all those vastly separated molecules all move together. They haven't any strings tied between them. And it's the same way when the little birds fly. In my boat in Sausalito, we have a lot of little tiny sandpipers. And they fly having one mind. They become a total organism when they fly. And they change direction instantly. I mean, it isn't that they turn like this and follow the leader. They're going like that, and then they go like that. And they're only individuals when they start pecking on the mud. Then they wander around all over the place and get up at the slightest movement, pow! They're all in the air again and going as one mind. Now, that's how your molecules move in your hand. So calculus pretends that the molecules are separate. They're not. They're related to each other by the space between them. And space is relationship. Space is order. I remember this once, a very vivid illustration. I had a friend who was giving a lecture, and she wanted us to use her studio for the lecture. And she had some, those canvas chairs that you pull open like that, and they have arms, canvas back, and canvas seat. You know, movie director's chairs. And she'd got them all lined up across the room, this way, zut, 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 zut. And she said, I can't possibly get all the people in here. I said, wait a minute, space is order. You say you don't have enough space, you do. So I put the speaker at that side of the room, and I arranged all the chairs round, coming across like that. Then the next row, then the next row, and the next row, and there were far more seats in there than they had before, you see. So space is order, and space is terribly important. But the Maya that I pointed out, you see, is that we ignore it. So, Maya is measurement. Thinging, chopping things into bits so as to count them. Number two, Maya is play. That is to say, it's a game. It's hide and seek. The universe is playing peekaboo with itself. Now you see it, now you don't. And the basis of that is the throb of vibration. Up and then down, up and then down. Which is male, female, positive, negative. Light, darkness, this side, that side. See? Everything is going... and it's going so fast that it seems to be continuous. But now you see it, now you don't. See? Solid space. Here and gone. Everything is that. See, if I put my hand on your knee and you leave it there, you cease to remember I'm there. But if I do this, you know I'm there all the time. Because each time it's renewed. Okay? So, it's play. Maya is also magic. And I gave the illustration of the theater, of creating the illusion that the drama is reality. All the illusory possibilities of the theatrical art. Then I meant specifically, Maya is art. Maya is skill in creating something. And I showed how the artist can give us all kinds of different visions of the universe. From the vision of, let's say, Giotto, with its amazing transparency, to Rembrandt, with its density, to the great Flemish painters like Van Eyck, who begin a photographic realism, onto the similar painters of the 19th century, and then through Picasso, and so on, to splashers like Jackson Pollock, all enabling us to see the world in different ways by their revelation. And so the possibilities of artistry are infinite. More and more artists will come and notice the world in different ways. And there are probably infinitely many ways in which the world can be noticed. Only the human mind works at a certain pace. It seems incapable of bringing more than a few at a time. It doesn't assimilate them. And then I discussed the final question. Does that mean that the world is nothing but our imagination? That is to say, going back to the analogy of the Rorschach blot, we say in testing a person on a Rorschach blot that he projects a story or a picture into the blot, and that reveals not something about the nature of the blot, but about the condition of his psychological structure. Are we going to have to say that in the same way, all scientific knowledge about the universe is a projection? You see, that's been very cogently argued. It's argued, for example, that laws of nature do not exist in nature, but are methods of measuring nature. In other words, to say that stones always fall downwards to the center of the earth, we invent for that the law of gravity. Now, is that a law? Is there something called the law of gravity which stones obey? Well, many scientists would say no. If the stone didn't fall to the ground, it would be a balloon. It obeys no law. It does that. And we make a law out of it simply because it happens regularly. If I regularly do what you tell me to, that becomes, in human affairs, a law. But nobody tells the stone that it's got to fall down. It just does so because that's part of the definition of being a stone. If it didn't, it would be a balloon, you see? Or a feather in the wind. So laws of nature are regarded by some scientists as tools invented by human beings. And to say that there is a law of gravity is neither more nor less true than saying there are 3 feet in a yard. Because we arranged it that way. Or there are 24 hours in a day. The laws are simply observed regularities. And we make these regularities by the way we look at things. We might not even notice that stones fell to the ground unless it was significant to us. But the difficulty of pushing that theory too far is that it makes the human mind ridiculously independent of the physical world. Say that everything is a projection out of the human mind would be to say that the human mind isn't really part of the world. But it is. Our being is continuous with the being of the whole universe, as I explained. Each one of us is something doing, just as every wave is something that the sea is doing. And, well, we are waves of the universe, and it's waving and saying, "Yoo-hoo, I'm here." And I'm called Alan Watts right now. But it's called so-and-so-and-so-and-so-and-so all around the room. But it's all the same thing doing this jazz. And I explained how we have been taught to ignore that and to be under the illusion that we're all separately. Now, that was what we were talking about this morning. Now, I want to press one aspect of this theme, particularly this afternoon, which is the aspect of play. The distinction, you see, the whole point is that a man who knows a woman, is it objectionable to you that we have to use man as the general word for human beings? Anyway, that the person who knows that this is Maya is, as I said, somewhat disconcerting because we know that he doesn't take life seriously. That is to say, he doesn't take it absolutely seriously. He takes it seriously up to a point. But as we might say, when it really comes down to it, he doesn't. Now, you might think that such a person would be extremely undependable. Therefore, he's ethically suspect. If he knows that all the distinctions between good and evil, and between life and death, between the valuable and the non-valuable, if he knows that all those distinctions are illusory, would he not be, we're afraid, a very dangerous person? Would he fail to keep his contract? Feel when he felt like it? Would he bump somebody off when it suited his convenience? Isn't it more trustworthy for human beings to believe that there are absolute laws, that it matters absolutely that you never kill anybody, etc.? Now, this is a very fascinating question. And I want to suggest to you, first of all, that a person who believes in absolute laws is liable to be quite dangerous. Because he puts rigid structures in a place of higher honor than, oh, such a good old word, but no longer used, inwit. I-N-W-I-T, inwit. And what is inwit? The Chinese have a word which has to be the gift and the essential virtue of a good judge. Good judge in the law courts. And this word, like this, you know, is pronounced li. There are several kinds of li in Chinese. But this one means an innate sense of fair play, of equity, which can't be written down in laws. It can't be formulated. They also have a word for laws that can be formulated, which is zi. Looks like that. Because that character was originally this, when they had picture writing. Two bars across, that's right. And that's a picture of a bronze cauldron with a knife beside it. Because in very ancient times, when people brought sacrifices to the sacrificial cauldrons, the rulers caused the laws to be engraved on the cauldrons so that they would read them. And the sages said that is a bad idea. Because the moment the people know what the laws are, in literal terms, they will develop a litigious spirit. And they will start haggling over words. So, although there has to be the tzu, the formulated law, a good judge must know a lot more than the written law. He must have a sense of equity. Because every case that comes to his attention is really different. There's no way of describing exhaustively all the possible relationships between man and man. And so a judge has to have this sort of rule of thumb, like a good gardener has to have a green thumb, which is something beyond anything you can read in a book. So, Li is the sense of justice. Zi would be belief in absolutes, in that you must never do so and so, or you must always do so and so. Thou shalt not. So a person who holds to absolute rules will be an inflexible fool when it comes to the test. He is reliable up to a point, but this is what you get in bureaucracy. I'm sorry to say it, but there is a specially offensive kind of usually female secretary of some government department who is utterly unreasonable, totally goes by the book, and will not, under any circumstances, do anything one way or the other beyond the letter. Well, people like that have a certain use, but they have the same sort of use as machinery. Machinery which is foolproof, which does the same everything every time, and it can't be changed. But there must always be some boss over this kind of person who can consider the case from a different point of view and say, well, obviously, in this case, the rules are unreasonable and they have to be altered. So, you see, a person who takes the laws absolutely seriously becomes inflexible and therefore mechanical and therefore inhuman. No, it's like the Roman Catholics when they get on this bit about birth control or divorce or something like that. They get utterly inflexible and they seem to enjoy being inflexible because they think it's a mark of tough-mindedness. You know, I've been most tremendous theological controversies going on these days. I don't know if you know it. Perhaps some of you don't read these things. But I have a certain interest in Christianity and I love reading the theological controversies. Well, there's a character called the Bishop of Woolwich in England who's written a book that stirred everybody up. There's not really anything new in it, but he's just suggesting that God isn't an old gentleman with a beard. And it seems to have created a terrific turmoil. And people, though, who are standing in the opposition to all this, want to say, all this liberal thinking is vague and therefore wishy-washy and gutless. To prove that you have guts, you've got to believe something absurd and stick to it. See? Come hell or high water, you believe that the Virgin Mary was sucked up bodily into heaven. You know? And she really went up. See? And brrr, all these other people are weak-minded because they reduce these eternal dogmatic truths to mere myths and symbols. See? And they get a sense of masculinity out of this, just in the same way as some people get a sense of masculinity out of being fascists. They believe we've got a real tough political theory. Colonel Dammit Shoot 'em All, we used to call them in England. And they stick to this and they say, oh, I feel like a man, you see? Or I feel like a real businesswoman, like Ayn Rand or whatever. You know, they like to be... I'm an individual, you see? Like that. But these people are inflexible fools because they have no give. They don't know when to give. And the whole art is to have a certain rigidity in life, but always to know when to give. See? That's judo. So in the same way, a person who takes life absolutely seriously doesn't know when to give. And he has this idea, you see, that life is a contest. And that we got to win. And we've got to win. Now, if you go into a battle with the idea that you've got to win, you get nervous. It's like walking across a wall with a big drop on one side, feeling that you've got to stay steady. You start worrying. And like someone once told me when I was a boy, that there was a certain examination and I simply must not fail it. It just, I had to get it, you know. I got just absolutely nonplussed by the whole situation. Because, you see, you've got to have a certain flexibility so that when you know it doesn't matter whether you win or lose, then you can really play. This is the secret of all gamesmanship. To play golf, you know, stop caring. You've got to learn some technique first, whatever it is. But then stop worrying. How do you think you drive a car? You learn the basic things to do, and then you go zooming along. It's terribly dangerous to drive a car. Much more unsafe than taking a ride in a plane. But yet we all do it. Nobody seems to worry much about it. Well, that's how to drive. But if you get nervous on the road, you react too fast, and you're all over the place, you're a mess and a nuisance. So you mustn't take it quite seriously. So then, the fellow who regards life as fundamentally an illusion would, on the whole, then be more reliable than the person who is in dead earnest. Because he has basically at his heart the most valuable human trait, which is the ability to come off it. You know, you say to someone, oh, drop it, you know. And in the end, you see, a man who can come off it, who may make a terrific case for some point of view, but has a certain twinkle in his eye. You see, this is a true human being and has what Confucius would call run, spelled J-E-N for some reason. This is human-heartedness. And that is human-heartedness because it is at the heart of the nature of things, and the nature of things is play. Now, we contrast here, you see, the two fundamental views of life as set forward in the drama. You remember the comic and the tragic masks. The tragic view of the world is that the world is a... You can take it from two points of view. They really come to the same thing. But one of the points of view is that in the tragic idea, the world contains the possibility of an irremediable disaster. Things can go wrong, 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 and the most vivid representation of the tragic view in all history is, of course, Christianity. Orthodox, old-fashioned Christianity, in which there is the possibility of eternal damnation. See, that is things going wrong always. It isn't the thing that it's not just a failure that you die and cease, but that you are tortured forever without hope of respite, forever and ever and ever and ever. That's the maximum tragic view of the world. So in that view of the cosmos, things are very serious indeed, because that might happen to you. And you must not let it happen. That's absolutely necessary to be avoided. Now, on the other hand, you see, although the Hindu and Buddhist mythologies have their various purgatories rather than hells, there's one called Avicii, which is the deepest of all these purgatories. And the souls that get lost in Avicii are there for an unendurably long time. Many kalpas, and a kalpa is 4,320,000 years. But in the end, they get out. In other words, when they've paid for their bad karma that gets them there, they get out and begin again. So it isn't quite serious. It's very serious, but not absolutely serious, you see? And that's the difference. So in this Hindu view, the Lord, in his Maya creation of the world, creates terribly serious situations. He scares himself out of his own wits by playing that he's all of us and imagining, forgetting who he is, you see, or what he is, and imagining that he's us, and he is terrified or thinks he is, by all the situations of life, and nevertheless, in the end, it turns out it was all a game. It was all hide and seek. Now, what about that, you see? When we think of that as a point of view, let's not ask whether or not it's true. No serious philosopher asks anymore whether things are true or not. He only asks whether they're plausible. We can say no more. It would be arrogance to say more. Truth is a dimension where we stop talking, you know. We know things in another way than words. But it's plausible because we could say, well, does a thing have to be absolute to be important? It's important that we make a distinction between good and bad. It's not good to murder people, generally speaking. You see, that's important. But to make it important, do we really have to make it absolutely important? See, I tell you, the religious mentality, or not only the religious mentality, but it's the kind of mentality you find around. What's the real secret of it is it loves to have something to condemn. One of the biggest kicks a person can have is to feel righteous indignation. And also, people who go to church love to be lectured and scolded. A real scoldy sermon from a Baptist preacher is a big, big bang. They come out feeling so satisfactory. So, supposing then we say, well, in the end, all the sinners and the dreadful people who lived in the world will realize that they were manifestations of God like everybody else. And some people stop and think about that and say, oh dear, it's a very dangerous doctrine. What they're really worrying about is that they are not going to have the satisfaction of seeing those people they don't like writhing in torment forever and ever. Now who ought to be fried in hell? You know? And so this is saying, you see, that if a thing is not important when it's not eternal, to say there was no point in singing a song because it came to an end. No, there was no point in marrying this girl because she eventually died. There was no point in anything that's finite in time, you see. That's the argument. But it obviously is important that a song be sung, even though it ends, that a person live, even though they die, because that's the rhythm of life. Who take this point of view, that what isn't ultimately serious isn't serious at all, are simply crude in their thinking. They just plainly lack judgment. They're like children who have to believe that two and two are always and invariably four, because they might say one day they were five. These children are a little whimsical. So then, the idea of Maya suggests two things, really, which are very difficult things for most of us to accept because they're so outrageous in comparison with our accustomed viewpoints. The one side of what it suggests is that life is not ultimately serious. If you fall far enough, you'll find there's no concrete to hit. Because you are one with a free floating universe that has nothing outside it. I sometimes say, you know, that when God created the world, what he really did, I gave you one other version of it this morning, but he said, have a ball. See, what are you going to do with this ball? There's nowhere to put it. It can't get lost. There it is. It's the ball of being, you see. Have a ball, see? So, the thought that all this life, which is so intensely involved and tragic and struggle, is really diaphanous. It's like a dream. Would you dare believe that? This is a test of nerve. The other side to the doctrine is that you, in your heart of hearts, are really the Lord, playing but being you. Will you dare believe that? I mean, we often say that's the touchstone of madness in our culture. A person who thinks he's God is really out of his wits. Only, of course, it depends what kind of a God you're thinking about. If you're thinking about Mr. Know-It-All, who can explain how everything's done, that would be one story. You'd be pretty much of a megalomaniac. But God, as the Hindus and Buddhists think of God, it's really wrong to use the word God, perhaps, for this being, or both neither being nor non-being. But in their idea, you see, the Lord doesn't have to know how things are done. He just doesn't. The same way you grow your hair without knowing how to. And so a person who realizes he is the Lord in disguise does not therefore claim to know all the answers to all possible scientific questions. But the conviction, you see, that you are somehow within the inmost depths of your being, the works, the reality of everything that there is, you see? You are it. Tattvamasi, it said in Sanskrit. That art thou. Now, is that... see, these two things. It isn't serious, and you are it. We react in our cultural background against these things because they seem to be haughty. They seem to be fantasy, fantastic, claiming too much, getting too big for one's boots, because we're used to feeling that we are right if we cringe. The moment we start talking ourselves down and saying, well, I'm just a little fragment of dust, come into being, I disappear, I'm a mess, I'm imperfect, I don't know anything, etc., 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 we feel safe when we do that. It's like feeling that you're right when you hurt. Oh, I bless the good Lord for my boils, for my mental and bodily pains, for without them my faith all congeals, and I'm doomed to hell's ne'er-ending pains. How very good it is for me to hurt so much. See? We've been brought up to feel that way. And also to be very careful about letting anyone know we're happy. The gods might overhear. And it's not good for you to be happy. You might get uppish. You might have hybris, pride, and start boasting to the heavens. And then the old gentleman would get annoyed, because the old gentleman was pretty insecure. And he doesn't like the children rushing around and stamping their feet. Something might happen. They might go too far, you see. So, to you. So then, if we can... Oh, but I... Excuse me. Pardon me for having the disgusting effrontery to exist. But you see, this is fake. It's as fake as it can be. It's phony. It's another kind of pride. How good I am at being humble. Huh? And it's terribly dishonest. And it is something that our cultural attitudes take very seriously. And the trouble is it that having taken this seriously, and having felt for so long, through literature, through schooling, through attitudes of teachers and preachers and parents, that it's good for us to be humble. When we revolt against it, we go make the opposite mistake, you see, of being unnecessarily cocky. because that's compensation. There is no need, you see, to take on the universe and say, I'm man, I'm the works, I'm the Lord in disguise, and all this can get lost. You don't need to do that. If you really know, you see, as I said at the end of this morning's talk, to believe that you are the disguised Lord is unnecessary. It's a form of doubt. So in the same way, to assert it in a kind of defiant way is also a form of doubt. Although, please remember, you're perfectly free to do that. Don't get caught in it by feeling that you oughtn't to. You know, I remember when I was a child, we used to read that the sin against the Holy Ghost was unforgivable. I just wonder what the sin against the Holy Ghost was. And there'd be a little thing at the back of your mind whispering, damn the Holy Ghost. To hell with the Holy Ghost, you know? It's just, you know, you're absolutely sucked into it by the very prohibition, the kind of vertigo where a person looks over a precipice, feels he's got to throw himself down. That's a funny thing in human psychology. So, in many forms of symbolism that you find in the Orient, there is the idea of the liberated man, who he is, who knows, as a man who can't be fazed. You know, for example, that Bodhidharma, who's supposed to have brought Zen to China, is made into a toy in Japan, which is like a shmoo, only it's this shape. And it's weighted so that you can't knock it over. Push it down, but it always springs up. And this is the sort of figure of this. It says a poem, seven times down and eight times up, such is life. Or it may be the image in Hindu literature of the tightrope walker, the man walking the path of the razor's edge. It's the balance again, you see. But the Bodhidharma is in a way more flexible. He can be pushed right to the floor, but the minute you let go, he's back up. Or the Taoist image of water. You can squeeze it, you can jump on it, you can cut it, but you can't hurt it. It always comes together again. Look, for example, I gave the illustration this morning of a human being as something like a whirlpool in water. Constantly changing, but always the same. Now, what happens if you chop up a whirlpool? You know, you can smash it, you can put your fist through it, and you can make it disappear for a while. But after a while, there's the pattern again. See? So in the same way, we think we can solve problems with violence. We think we can look killing people as an answer to a problem. It's only temporary. As if you knock out, say, a Hitler, another one comes up. Because you haven't understood the problem of this sort of manifestation. Anything that's destroyed with violence eventually recurs again. Because the persistence of life in its continuity is a persistence of patterns. So long as the, for example, the principles of surface tension hold true, or the principles of crystallization, you're going to get crystals everywhere. Anywhere in the universe, you're liable to get a crystal of something or other. Well, life is the same kind of thing. It's a pattern which is going to keep cropping up. Doesn't matter how long it has to wait. A million years is nothing. You blot it out here, it'll turn up somewhere else. It's only a matter of time, because it's in the nature of the patterns. So in this sense, then, let's review these two ideas. It's, first of all, seriously speaking, sincerely speaking, I should say, is it demoralizing to believe that it's all play? That at the last minute, no, when the screaming memes are right on and everything is awful, at the very last minute, Will you wake up and find it's a dream? You could say, I hope so. I hope so. But life sometimes gets so black that it's impossible to hope so. You know it's the end. Now, I remember once a marvelous conversation with Count von Durkheim, who is a kind of German Zen master. And he said, you know, during the war, people have the most utterly soul-searing experiences. He said the three general kinds of experience, of course, in the air raids, when you heard the whistling bomb right above you, and you knew that was the end. But sometimes it was a dud. And it didn't go off. But you resigned yourself as you heard that scream and completely accepted the fact that you were about to cease to exist. Or else you were in a concentration camp and you saw absolutely no hope of ever getting out alive. Absolutely none whatever, and you gave up. Or, he said, you were displaced. The town where you worked and you had your occupation was erased. And you were a person with absolutely no background, no career, no future, nothing. And you accepted it. Now, he said, so often in all these cases, the individual concerned had the most extraordinary experience. They had, in other words, the cosmic consciousness. Satori. They woke up. They realized suddenly that there was nothing to worry about at all. That I... The real I, not the superficial ego, the real I is the whole cosmos. Then he said their friends, they tried to explain this to their friends afterwards. And their friends said, oh, you're crazy. You were under such strain that you got a little touched. And so they would try to forget it and put down this experience. He said, most of my work is in reviving this and telling people that this is an authentic experience. So that's what I mean, that the gamble, that it isn't really serious. If you don't, at the last moment, you see, as it were, call in the police, if you don't scream for help, I'm using that as a metaphor. To accept, well, I'm going to die. See? That's it. There's nothing to hold on to, you see? The moment you really stop holding on to anything, because you see there is nothing to hold on to, what happens? You become the ball. Now, the ball, it has nowhere to bounce, you see? You become the ball. There's nothing to hold on to. But you can only see that when you're not holding on to anything anymore. And you've given up. Resignation, or whatever it is. In other words, that urgency to succeed, to be something, to get there, to make it, to be right. When you see, you can't, and you give up. You get reborn. Because that's the death. The real meaning of going to heaven after death has nothing to do with literal death. It has to do with this death. Now, the other side of the picture. What about the notion that you're it, Tattvam Asi? Not only that it isn't serious, but that fundamentally, right at the root of things, you are the ultimate reality. Not you, as I repeat,
as this apparently separate ego, that is a kind of phantom, like the equator, a social institution. But the you, which, as I say, grows the hair and blues the or browns the eyes and so on. Now, the difficulty to our common sense, and it does present a difficulty to our common sense, is that we've all been brought up to feel alienated from the world. In the sense that it is something we came into. And it is something that we confront. A meeting. We face it. So we face facts. We face reality. We encounter. Martin Buber's emphasis on dialogue, on I-thou, the confrontation. See? That's a silly notion. At least, it's silly if it doesn't have something undergirding it. In other words, you can't have a relationship without an underlying unity. You can't have a battle, even, between the tiger and the shark, because they have no common ground. And Tweedledum and Tweedledee agreed to have a battle. So underlying all conflict in nature is common ground, unity. Because even when we say that two things are the poles apart, that's a way of saying they're connected. Because the whole earth joins the two poles. The whole magnet joins the north and the south poles. So, just as we have been taught to ignore the background behind the figure, the space behind the solid, so also we've been taught to ignore the joining link between the two poles. I once said that the way most of us think, somebody asks for a banana, he ought to be satisfied with just the two ends of the banana. See? When you can go so fast from San Francisco to New York that the intervening United States is abolished, San Francisco and New York become the same place. And so there's no point to going to New York. But just if there's a distance between them, so some difficulty in getting from one place to the other, so that not everybody in New York can go to San Francisco, not everybody in San Francisco can go to New York, then they're different places, and it's worth going there. So also, for the two ends of the banana to have any significance, you've got to have the banana of which the two ends are ends. So in the same way, each individual isn't something that comes into the world from nowhere and confronts it, or from somewhere else altogether. And the universe is not a kind of heap of flotsam and jetsam that happen to collect in space like a bunch of old rubber tires and broken logs in some little nook on the San Francisco Bay. Because there was the bay underneath the whole thing, you see, actually. So in the same way, to think... See, the Christians have, and the Jews, to some extent, have got over this idea that we are created out of nothing. Now, of course, there's an esoteric sense to that. In a way, a maya, an illusion, is a creation out of nothing. But suddenly the magician makes a phantasm to appear in the empty room. In a way, that's a creation out of nothing, see? He does it, say, by hypnosis. Magic. But this idea of being created out of nothing has certain psychological and moral overtones, or undertones, in which you are supposed to be nothing. down to the marrow and core of your existence. See, what that means is, psychologically, that there's someone wagging his finger at you and saying, never forget that you are really a jerk. You see? That you're a little worm. You don't deserve anything. You exist entirely by the grace and pleasure of another. And the sooner you grovel suitably to acknowledge this, the better. Because the consequences of saying this and the meaning of saying this is what's going to be done about it. But so there's the choice, you see, in your thinking, in your myth-making, in your imagination. Do you want to settle for a completely schizoid universe in which there is a gulf between the Lord and the illusion, the Brahma and the Maya, so total that forever and ever the one is not the other? Or would you rather have a unified, integrated universe in which the Maya is something that the Lord is doing? It's his act, his play. Or its act, if you don't like the masculine personal pronoun. Her act, the Great Mother. And it seems to me that these two views are sort of like this, you see. We could diagram them. See, one person is looking at the universe this way. Here's the domain of existence, being. And everything comes into it thus, from nowhere. See? That's one way of looking at things. How this ever got together, you can't even think. You have to turn your mind inside out and get this kind of collected flotsam and jetsam idea. The other diagram is this. Here again is the domain of being. But it's like a star. It radiates. The whole of it radiates each individual point of focus. You see? Now there you've got an integrated situation. And that's what things look like. Stars look like that. Crystals look like that. Octopuses look like that. Spiders look like that. Human beings stick out like that. It all works that way. Because underneath the differences, there are the differences all the way around, is the unity. If you don't know unity, you don't know you're different. They go together.
This is KPFK Los Angeles. We've just heard Alan Watts with part four, concluding the seminar, Reality, Art, and Illusion.